consider this to be like a rolling meeting, and people can pop in and out as they can. Because some folks have to leave early too, and everybody's involved in a lot of emergencies now.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and record this, and we can make this available afterwards.
Okay. If anybody minds about that, let us know.
I'll check with my agent.
That's fine.
I guess agents are desperate these days, huh? Kurt, do you want to kick it off? What do you prefer?
I'll say welcome to everybody, and you know, welcome to this altered reality that we're all living in. I think we wanted to, you know, first and foremost, just have the opportunity to check in with folks and kind of get ourselves regrounded in the work that this group is trying to do, taking into account the dramatic shift that's happened. So I think we wanted to start by just kind of going around and checking in with people. Peter, do you have any other initial thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's the great opening, I think, just to make sure everybody's okay. And if there's anything we can do from wherever we are to help anybody who needs it. Or maybe get some tulip bulbs from Willem.
That's like, it. I don't know. Just got it.
Just to jump into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Tom. I really appreciate you guys talking about the new world that we live in, because the spectacular work that this little group has done to this point was really headed to some interesting conclusions. And now the pathway might change, the conclusions might change. But the one thing I can say is that the work is more important than ever. I hope that during the call today, we can talk about that as much as anything, and how do we readjust and refocus some of our strengths towards some kind of impactful reports going to the public when this is done.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say, Kurt, that among like the emails I've seen come in the last 5 minutes from like Norm, who can't join us because of an emergency, and Philippe, who can't, and then Angela sent an email that she's running late. But one came in from Applewood, Newski's Applewood Smoked Bacon, saying that my next shipment is on the way. So
excellent. Just in time for Passover. That's excellent.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's on the way. So if anybody needs any of that, I'll peel off a couple strips and put it in a envelope.
Well, I'll jump in off the airtime. I am, I'm well. Most of the people I know are still well. I'm in Northern California. I'm struck that institutions now are wrestling a lot with how to adapt. Like at the high level, they're all a little bit freaked out and uncertain. And I don't know if it's possible to offer guidance from this group that would give a little more courage to people that are running schools or trying to respond, but to the extent people are hung up or held up by worries about use of open resources or use of closed resources under fair use, maybe there's some position to take. The second thing that strikes me is there's a huge number of COVID-related funds. There's a lot of, I think everybody recognizes there's an emergency, there's a certain amount of willingness on the part of funders to put money towards dealing with extraordinary circumstances. There's not much strategy in how to do that. But if you look at Canada.org and their list of COVID emergency response funds, it's very long. At least one of them is devoted to misinformation. I'm guessing there are others that are devoted to education. So it may be a moment for prospecting along those lines. And then the third is just a case in point. I've been watching the National Emergency Library and the fight with the Authors Guild and the initial very favorable coverage about, well, gee, all the students are locked out of all the libraries. Isn't it good someone's doing something about it? And the unchallenged reprinting of trade association position statements in the New York Times yesterday about, oh gosh, isn't it awful that this billionaire is stealing from authors. Seems like that's going to be debated long after the emergency passes, but it may be something that some of the people on this call, either individually or collectively, would want to say something about. So those are my three.
Good stuff, Jeff. Yeah, if there was ever a time for flexible thinking, it's here. Anyone else like to share?
Yeah, Lisa here from ISKME, sitting in Half Moon Bay, also in Northern California, where my immediate circle as well. Some folks are sick, but doing okay. And Cable, hi. Cable and I were just on another meeting with people from all over the world with UNESCO this morning. And I'm going to say something that I said there that I got more insight from the call too, and what you just said, Jeff. So let me try to articulate this here. You know, there's so much talk about, you know, there's no going back to normal. We know that. And there's all the optimism of the, you know, there's less pollution. We know we need less. We're all connected, like all of these really important, really good things. And at the same time, there's like, and I like how you just said it, Jeff, this unchallenged, you know, the unchallenged proposition in the New York Times, you know, op-ed yesterday, if you saw that, about the National Emergency Library and the Authors Guild just, you know, basically saying, yeah, this billionaire is stealing from everybody, right? So I guess what I want to say is whenever there's an emergency and things are no longer normal and everything is disrupted, there's a huge void. And the void has so much, there's so much hope and optimism and people working towards that, like the number of national governments that are supporting artists right now and paying their rent. And I mean, there's so much good of things we're seeing, but then there's things like that that I'm laying awake at night, kind of worried about that gap and that void that are going to be filled. There's a lot of attack, and some of it is very subtle. At least the New York Times op-ed was right in the open, but you know, everything from, you know, and I don't need to go into our government politics, but you know, there are things being, you know, taken away everywhere, and some of them are unchallenged because we're, you know, in this big emergency. And I think many of you probably saw there was this huge spreadsheet. It had like 1,000 entries in it. Go enter here, all you people who have commercial content. And, you know, if you want to make your content free now, and it was like this big deal, and everybody went to it, you know, and I looked at it, and I'm like, there's no way I'm putting anything about ISKME and our OER work there, because that was all about people who will continue to charge afterwards. So they're, you know, they're kind of preying, on one hand, I could say they're preying, P-R-E-Y, on people who just are desperate for content, and that's important, and that's all a teacher or an educator cares about right now. How do I get this up and learning? Yet at the same time, there's like, it's completely unchallenged that, you know, and when you're in a crisis, you know, that's not the time to say, hold it, is that thing you're taking, can you actually use that 6 months from now, or is it going to leave a big hole in your curriculum, right? We can't. That's not kind of the time to say it, especially not to an educator who just needs something in that moment, right? So I don't know. I'm a little bit rambling here, but I'm troubled and thinking and don't feel like, and I'm troubled because I don't myself and for my organization feel like we're really articulating and working towards those issues in that way. So what's going unchallenged? And I think about open, you know, the library, the National Emergency Library, is just one example of that. And I know there's good things. I mean, Cable, you talked about the Open Science Initiative and talking to WHO. So I know there's good too. I'm not trying to be, you know, full of doom and gloom. I'm just worried that we're not being proactive enough on some of these things.
Mm. Lisa, I'm curious if you've witnessed maybe the starting point of a community response, a coordinated way to challenge some of the things that need to be challenged there. Do you hear anything?
I mean, I think some of us are just sort of working informally on that. Like, I'm part of this UNESCO coalition that is trying, was about to do a huge launch of their OER initiatives to all their member states right when COVID struck. In fact, the big meeting in UNESCO that had been kind of planning for 2 or 3 years was canceled at the last minute. It was one of the first things canceled. It was like March 2nd. So for example, there's a group there that's where we were talking, some of us for the first time this morning about, responding very deliberately to what's going on now. But I think like all organizations, we're all kind of looking internally and saying, oh, how could we leverage more time? How can I pivot from what I was doing? I challenged my team yesterday, even among our developers and engineers to say, like, what would you do differently in your job, tomorrow, given what we know today? And we do great work and it's remote and it's about electronic resources that are openly licensed and we work with librarians all over the world and yeah. But this is different. Like, what is different now and what is it? So I think that, to answer your question directly, Kurt, I think that I'm not really seeing a coordinated effort yet. I'm seeing a lot of individual efforts. All of our individual efforts are partnered. I mean, we do almost nothing alone. We work with, 30 states across the country. We're working with them, but it's not coordinated. We're not lifting that up a level to see how these things are all connected, I guess.
Hal, yeah.
Myself muted here so that you didn't hear the dog barking. Hi, everybody. So just to check in on a personal level, we're fine. And in our little bubble here, barely going out. So trying to stay healthy. I wanted to report in on one thing and then throw a wacky idea out on the table. And I got up and just update you. I got a welcome call, about a week ago from Dr. Gary Michelson's team. Our friend Ryan, who's usually part of this group, I don't think he's here today, but and Dr. Michelson, you know him, he's the 20 Million Mind Foundation. And he looked at this and he felt an immediate need to see if he could intervene in the public conversation through an op-ed that he proposed that we jointly author, warning academic jurisdictions at all levels, K-12, college, about making terrible mistakes in the contracts that they execute as they rush toward online education. Mm. And I'm seeing that right here in Palo Alto, where my daughter's at Palo Alto High School, where they were completely caught unprepared for this, where they've had nothing useful to share with the kids educationally, and where they're about to make some what appear to be grievous errors in how they're going to proceed to rush things online. Of course, the enterprises that can offer school districts across the country turnkey academic experiences are typically proprietary. And so if your goal is to have something up by the end of spring break, which is in 7 days from now, you're easy pickings for those enterprises. So we're offering a piece. One thing we could use your help with, Angela from Hewlett has kindly dispatched her PR team to try and, once our piece is finished, Dr. Michelson is reviewing it now. We plan a series of these, but at least we're trying to get the first one out of the gate. Angela has put Hewlett's PR, some of us have worked with them before. Hewlett has a PR team on retainer that places op-eds and articles and tries to get people on PBS NewsHour and things like that. Angela's put them to work on our behalf, although we still have to give them the content, which we hope to finalize in the next few days. So if any of you, once these pieces are, and particularly the first piece is ready, if any of you have any contacts that we may not have, we would love to see this piece, the initial piece, and what follows get attention in major publications. We'd love to see it in the Washington Post, New York Times, something like that. So if any of you have any connections in those places and might be able to help us get placement for these pieces, which I assure you are consistent with the values we have here, That would be really welcome. Just shoot me a note offline. We hope to start circulating them sometime in the next few days, assuming Dr. Michelson is and I can find agreement on the content, and we're working towards that. The idea I wanted to put on the table is one thing that came up as I was beginning to think this through and think through what arguments we want to make, is that school districts don't have, and colleges as well, don't have an independent, authoritative expert panels that they can turn to for unbiased reactions when they are about to execute a contract. And they don't even typically know what questions to ask in terms of how are student rights, how privacy rights protected, how is content dealt with, who owns the content, who owns the homework, who owns the right to share the information after the contract terminates, what does the school district maintain after a contract terminates, what rights does the district have that it's giving up. Some of these contracts, as the PIRG report recently illustrated, even contain clauses that prevent school districts from talking about what's in the contract once the contract has been signed, and all sorts of things like that. So my crazy idea is, given the level of expertise and personnel on this panel, could we form, or could we conceive of moving towards forming, some kind of an expert advisory group that could make itself available to comment on public contracts with ed tech companies as they race to this online education opportunity. And I don't have a proposal or anything more than that idea, but I just got to thinking that this is, you know, we've got a fire raging all around the world, but in particular here in our country, of marketing deceptions designed to take advantage of this crisis to lock school districts into arrangements that they may suffer from literally for decades in some cases. And is there a way that we could think about intervening? It may be too big an ask, but that's what I woke up wondering about this morning. Anybody know anybody who can get our pieces into the New York Times or Washington Post? And can we stand up any entity that could provide authoritative advice to public entities that might seek it before they make some terrible mistakes?
So Hal, I dropped in the chat, as you know, GMMB is funded by Hewlett to do OER comms, and they've got connections at all the major papers, so you might ping them.
That's who I'm already working with. I was looking for anything beyond that, but that's our first approach.
Yeah, and offline, I think we can definitely talk about particular editors at the Post and the Financial Times, and you know, wherever else is the larger thing. The chat room is on fire, Hal, with support for your idea, just so you see it.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't looked at that, yeah. Yeah, and I don't know how we do it or how we get there or who organizes it. I'm not looking at anybody on the screen here who looks like they have lots of extra time on their hands. Or how we would make the existence of this entity unknown. But you know, if MIT and ISCME and Creative Commons and some of the other open courseware consortiums, some of the other groups I see represent, if we threw our authority onto a jointly shared letterhead and let folks know that we were available. Gee, we could even make it paid consultations. You know, they're spending money. We'll evaluate a contract with a learning entity and provide a report within 72 hours for $1,500.
Maybe there's some kind of task force that the EFF could do on education or something like that. Mm. Like we could partner with an existing group and just... tilt some of our work in that direction.
Hal, it seems like there's definitely a group of people to get together to, I'm not sure if it's to write additional pieces You know, I had to just sort of laugh and thank you for saying what I, you know, I told you what I was laying awake thinking and you were coming up with a solution. So thank you for that. You know, I'm not sure that the commercial sector would see us as, you know, unbiased. You know, you said that an unbiased, you know, group that these school districts should go to, you know, that's kind of interesting to think about. We're certainly not unbiased. We bring our open perspective. Of course, we're also trying to just protect education institutions that are making really bad decisions without enough information. So it's a little bit of both. You know, it's kind of interesting to think about how to kind of skirt that line of obviously having a bias towards open, but
But then there's
the issues around privacy. And I mean, so all of those things are an ownership. I mean, that's the angle. But so it's not like it's about OER per se. It's about what we know about those other pieces that support it. I just wonder if there's some other joint writing. I'm glad you're heading this off with Michelson to do that. But are there other pieces? Like, could we be writing a series? Could they somehow be tied together? Would a school district know where to find, you know, us and even want that? Or is it about helping to start conversations, right? Could enough of written pieces be out and could we put them in, you know, places where school board members are reading and, you know, other folks like that to really, to even just become aware of the issues? Because you're right, they're absolutely not thinking.
Yeah, I mean, one of the questions that I think we were looking to put forward to this group is if we were to start today, you know, our work instead of in May of last year, what would we do and what would we do differently and what would we pronounce as the most important deliverables? And Jeff, I know you might have to go for part of this call and miss it, but like just picking up on your opening remarks, you know, the idea of giving people courage in this time, I think is an amazing mandate. And I think the idea of resource guides, as you mentioned them, would be fantastic. So there are these short-lived advocacy pieces that could appear in the press, but there are also resource guides to that could live longer and that could, you know, sort of be continually updated that we could provide. And I know Kurt and Tom was on the call and I have been talking about MIT's role in perhaps, you know, preparing some documents like this for transforming a knowledge institution, because this might not be the last time we do it. But Hal's topic is amazing.
Can I say something?
Yes, please, Claudia.
I think that this exercise needs to be two-pronged. I think it's very helpful and very useful if as much warning is given as possible, bottom-ups to school districts or individual universities, outlining all the many issues that come with rash decisions and signing terms and conditions that end up dictating how you behave for years to come. But there's a broader issue, which often comes in crises. I've actually been doing some work looking back at what happens in society with this type of crisis. And you get regulators and politicians to want to regulate very closely what caused the problem and to deregulate everything else. So we start to see calls in conservative circles. The National Review had an article about 10 days ago saying, please deregulate the whole economy, right? Throw away everything so that we can get private business to rebuild the country. Specifically in California, a number of trade associations have asked to postpone or scrap altogether the onset of a number of privacy laws. There needs to be a voice that protects some of the principles such as privacy, because the tendency will be again to try to do away with all of this on a societal level as a tool to drive growth. And so if we're going to have op-eds, it's useful to have op-eds bottom up on what schools should do. I think it's very important to actually get out in the open the debate about why should we scrap privacy laws. What's good about that? Why should we scrape any regulation just for the sake of it? But certainly the ones that we are discussing now.
Great. And welcome to those who just joined. We've actually moved into the part of the conversation that is, you know, what can this group do in the face of this national, international health emergency, but also what is equally an international information emergency and an international, most importantly, education emergency. Lisa, you mentioned UNESCO and the data from UNESCO about the number of students who are out of school now worldwide is jaw-dropping. There has never been a moment in time like this. Okay.
To Antonin's point, we need the active counterpoint to people claiming that they need some kind of deregulation to help their businesses thrive. We need to describe open businesses as the only scalable solution that works for an entire population. And it feels like that requires a commercial lobbying arm and people who are speaking directly to employment in the sector and a description of open education as a sector and framing it as a different part of the economy. But the defensive posture doesn't work very well if the offensive posture is saying, clearly we're the only people who are providing these kinds of educational services at scale, and you need it at scale, so work with them. It's like what I always feel about the Authors Guild. There isn't really the alternative. The alternative guilds that we've tried to set up don't, you know, the Authors Guild is only 10,000 people, but we don't have 100,000 person counterpoint. Even though the whole point is we are all authors and everyone who teaches a class is now a teacher and should be included.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. Thanks, SJ. So I'm trying to follow both the conversation that we're having here and also a very active conversation happening on the chat that's kind of in parallel and supporting what we're speaking about here. It would be nice to just pull out a couple things that are going on in the chat and bring those into the conversation as well. There's a conversation for Peter, Jeff, about universities having released their own guidelines on contracts that a group of schools perhaps could collaborate on similar principles from Peter. Would you like, Peter, would you like to say anything more about that? Can't hear you, Peter. You're on mute.
Sorry, I've had my camera off because I'm in a low bandwidth part of the country. I may have to turn the camera off again. But just quickly, what I had to say is already in the chat area. Several schools have thought hard about principles that ought to guide negotiations with publishers on good subscription contracts. They're hard to produce, and one university's list may not work well for another university, but they are a start for any university thinking about what a good contract would look like. And I'm thinking that some analogous principles could be developed for these ed tech contracts. And even if the list doesn't initially match the needs of all institutions, again, it would be a good start. And if you had five or six such lists, then any school negotiating a new contract would at least have some guidelines to look at rather than improvise.
And to get such a resource out in the hands and have it be visible to the people who need to see it. Any thoughts?
These lists I'm talking about are all open access. Yeah. It was important to the schools not just to have principles for internal use, but to publicize them.
Right. So, Kurt, on your question, again, a fantasy, but what I would love to see is, and I don't know enough to know, but, you know, what are the big trade publications for IT buyers in K-12 and in higher education? Are there places that the people who make financial decisions for IT in the public schools and public colleges routinely look? And what I would love to do is to see if we could get an emergency request in front of a funder to buy an ad, a big ad, prominent ad, with as many of our organizational names on it as possible, pointing to the kind of guidelines that Peter was just talking to. Maybe we don't have to create them ourselves. Maybe there's a set of guidelines that are out there, and we could position them exactly as what they are. This is not a final and complete set of guidelines, but here are some initial thoughts that you should be considering, with some place where they could contact organizations under our umbrella that they could reach out to for expert consultative guidance. I know when I was a school board member, a college board member, whenever we were about to commit to a major contract for solar panels on our parking lot, a major contract to, you know, build a new building or whatever, or to put out a bond issue, we would routinely hire non-vendor experts to come in and advise us on the contracts that we were entering into. So that's a kind of a thing that these governing boards are used to doing. It's a method that they're used to. And it would be wonderful if we could somehow come rapidly bring the kind of guidelines that Peter is talking about and make them accessible and visible to the purchasing agents who in the next 2 or 3 weeks are going to be making some terrible mistakes.
To echo Hal and Peter, I think that would be an incredible service to curate those guidelines and to make sure with everyone who has produced them that, you know, we could bring them together in a place or point toward them or whatever. And just to take a breath for a minute in our call and say that, you know, as Yvonne so wisely put it in a group call that we had the other day, you know, we have to honor the work that we've done to date as this Open 2020 working group. That said, there's extraordinary energy on this call, no surprise. Extraordinary commitment on this call, no surprise, to pivoting some and focusing our capacities on this emergency. And so the question, I guess, worth raising is if we were to pivot some of our work, or if we were to announce, or if we were to, you know, self-describe our work now, how best to prioritize deliverables that we could issue as a group and as a latent group, because there are many more members than are here today. We have 16 people on the call, 14 now. Let's throw that out there.
Well, there's certainly, just to tie it to the early part of the conversation, I mean, there are marketing efforts that I think are one piece of this. And in addition to getting out those guidelines, I mean, immediately we could be writing some, op-ed pieces for Ed Week and Chronicle of Higher Ed to, again, at least get the story out there immediately. It might take another couple of weeks to actually, I love how the idea of the, you know, take an ad out in some of these places where the CTOs are making where they what they're looking at to make purchasing decisions. But because this is happening so quick, it also seems like it's important to get the word out more generally, so other people will be saying to those folks, have you looked at these guidelines? What do you know about that? So it seems, Peter, you know, directly, I mean, this is a nice way to kind of what we're talking about again early in the conversation. How do we take our individual efforts that we're doing in these areas. You know, Cable, you talked about some of yours, we talked about some of ours. You know, they're about, you know, writing, right? So do we need sort of delegate or just self-organize around some of these writing pieces, as Hal's done with Michelson? And then there's the actual outreach piece. Who do we know that we can get these things placed? And certainly in the education journals, I can help there. And then there's the actual, the curation of these guidelines and whether it's a, you know, it can't be too heady. It can't be a, you know, I saw some guidelines for something like this morning and it was like 12 pages long. And it's almost like it has to be a very simple kind of toolkit, you know, and that might be something that we could be able to get funded in some way. Because if it's going to be some long heady thing, nobody's ever going to read it right now. You know, that's just not going to happen. So how could we do that as well?
I like that.
And there are a couple of points that I think, if emphasized right up top, can really grab people. Like the idea that many of these contracts, as the PIRG report revealed, have gag rules in them. Once you sort of grab someone's attention by letting them know how draconian, how obviously antithetical to public interest some of these typical contract requirements are, then you could back into maybe point five or six is talking about open content versus proprietary content or something like that. But there are some common features. The PIRG report, that's the focus of the work that Ryan and others have been promoting from the Michelson Foundation, you know, also talked about limits that are placed on how many students per class can print out materials when these inclusive access contracts are part of the mix. So there are a few sort of really, you know, don't agree to any contracts that have these terms, a gag rule, limits on the number of things that your students can print out, a lack transparency in pricing. And you could go to the PIRG report and pull out what those factors are. And then, you know, for people who want to drill into the really detailed nuances of it all, well, that's where maybe ISCME is available as a consultant on a consultancy basis or something like that, or some, not to single them out, but maybe there are other players on the call here this morning who would like to make themselves available as consultants to school districts who could actually parse individual contracts. But getting out the big picture items that need to be that people need to be aware of. And these are not, as the PIRG report revealed, these are not, you know, imagined bugaboos. These are actual ingredients of contracts that were part of the 53 contracts that PIRG looked at when they audited all these. And I don't know who's the best graphic artist to snappily put together a quick one-page ad, but I think if we put together, if somebody knew how to do that, or we could find somebody who knew how to do that, then it would be a matter of shopping it around to foundations to see if Hewlett can help, or 20 Million Minds, or anybody else that we know, and say, look, would you pay to help us put this ad out there to educate public purchasing managers on an emergency basis about the landmines to avoid in the online education contracts that they may be about to sign?
So it seems like there's two reinforcing threads to this. There's articulating the opportunity that this crisis has created by dislodging a bunch of, you know, more entrenched ways of doing things. Articulating the kind of upside that, you know, a recommitment, a deeper commitment to open, on the lines of, say, the Creative Commons blog post from a couple weeks ago puts out, for instance. And on the other hand, reinforcing it with, and if you don't do this really carefully on a kind of tactical basis, you know, with the decisions you're making right now, here's the bad things that can happen. And those two things really reinforce each other and feed in a productive way, I think.
To chime in with a a couple of other ideas to add into the mix. One is that these are some of the ideas we've been talking about with the communications firm GMMB, who we work with on contract, and we have our comms call this coming Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific. So I know many of you are on that list, but if you'd like to be included, send me a note and I'd be happy to add you, because it's not only for Hewlett grantees, but also members of the open education community who want to be thoughtful and strategic around communications and sharing. And then the other piece is, as I think about sharing out these kinds of resources that might be developed, there's I think it'd be great to circle back with like MJ, who's connected with the Doers group and the state system leaders, the regional compacts. So that'd be Tanya, who some of you met at the last meeting, as well as CCC OER, Una Daly, who runs that network. And that's a great way to reach some of the institution and system leads and champions for this work. And the third piece I'll add, I guess, is that I've been thinking about this too, and like how and when and who is sharing. And I had a great call with the student PIRGs earlier this morning, Caitlin and Kaylin. And there is something quite powerful about sharing these kinds of this advice and messaging from a student perspective. I do wonder about like how and when to advocate for this work in a way that doesn't sound opportunistic for organizing, you know. So I think there's an interesting balance that we have to navigate in terms of the making sure that educators are aware of these options with OER, but you know, making sure that we're sharing the messages in a way that when and in a way that they're ready to hear.
I would say to add to that, as someone who lives with an educator, I've been told that she is just getting kind of constantly inundated with resources and tips and things to help, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's kind of a deluge and challenging to really differentiate and spend time sort of going through those. Excuse me. So I would definitely echo the idea of thinking strategically of, you know, any resource that we create, how we deploy it and how we make awareness of it. And I second the CCC OER idea potentially as well. I think they're a great organization to potentially share out something.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I think those are great points that Angela has made. And one of the ways that I think it may seem less opportunistic for us, and I recognize that challenge, is if we imagine that this is, you know, this is not a response so much to COVID-19, but this is a situation that will endure. It may reappear again, most likely will. It's a situation that's totally long-term. Everything has changed pretty much. And so if we adopt that long-term perspective, it highlights the importance of why we need to come up with foundational principles that will make sure bad decisions like the ones Hal is speaking of don't get enshrined in contracts and agreements.
Yeah. So we'll do a little time check. Thanks, Peter, for summarizing that. I think we planned to be on till 3:30, and we definitely wanted to spend a little time kind of integrating all of this new thinking back into the work that we've been doing, as Peter mentioned, you know, honoring the work that we've done. And I think there's some important decisions to be made about what happens to the priorities that we thought we had 2 months ago. And in particular, there's a few projects that that people had committed to and we're hoping to get progress on, where we might want to rethink how all of this fits together. You know, first on the list of deliverables was, I think Cable and Ryan were trying to work, lead the charge on this roadmap, right? You might say there is still a roadmap, but we quantum leap tunneled to a different spot than we thought we were in a couple months ago. But the, you know, kind of across all of those deliverables, is there a little bit of a rethink about where the group's attention ought to be going?
I'll jump in and ask Ryan to jump in as well on this deliverable. We chatted just a little bit on email and acknowledged what I think we're all dealing with right now. COVID has changed what we do. It's changed how we're living. In addition to the additional stresses just on, you know, families and taking care of people and taking care of ourselves, all of our organizations are not working less. We're working a lot more for all the reasons that we've said, right? Now is the time to not only blunt negative things, which are stepping into the void, but now is the time to put the pedal down on emphasizing why open is important, not just in crisis, but beyond. I just shared one link, but if you look at the CC blog, you'll see that we've had this like rapid fire set of blog posts out about open access, open science, open education. And Lisa mentioned, we're talking with the WHO right now, and they're actually having conversations internally at the WHO saying, you know, our stance traditionally has been to protect and encourage IP for drug manufacturers, et cetera, who create vaccines. And that's an important part of global health. And it still is, but COVID has us rethinking that maybe we should think less about the importance of restrictive IP, and we should be thinking more about the global health side of the scale. And maybe that changes how we think about where we make our set our priorities, et cetera. And so anyway, to say all that is, we're all super busy, and I wonder if it's worth a conversation among the leads or the people who have agreed to co-lead these different things about whether or not, just to be blunt, if we have time right now to keep pressing forward with these, or if we should pause, or even if these are still the right mix. Are there other things like what, you know, Hal proposed that we ought to be focusing our attention on? Ryan, you want to say anything else about that?
Yeah, I'll echo some of Cable's comments. I've already reached out to him to apologize, and obviously apologies to the group. This past month has been extremely busy on our end. My hope was that we would be having some time between probably March 15th and April 15th for Cable and I to sort of collaboratively work on this and then have something ready for the group on April 15th. And just realistically, from a time crunch, that is not going to happen. I'm definitely still, I mean, I think that this is a valuable idea and one that I think we could probably tweak based on, COVID and our work towards COVID, because I think, when we're talking about this ideal state, if you will, I think that the current situation has really put into stark reality, what we would need to be in an ideal state. And I don't know if it's, looking within this, we readdress and say, okay, if COVID happens again, or, you know, something similar in 5 years, 10 years, whatever, like what are the differences between where we are now and where we want to be? So all that to say, echoing Cable's comments, that I think it would be a good idea to sort of reassess timelines, as well as commitments. I definitely think that I would want to still be interested in co-leading this initiative with someone. I think like the time frame of what we originally had envisioned just won't be realistic from my perspective.
Maybe we could look at that April 15th date, which was a haunted date for some of us in previous lives, whatever, and consider, like, maybe we need to update our list of deliverables with can't do it until 2025, or would prefer to work on this now, or some mix of those things. I can say that the idea of resource guides that Jeff mentioned at the outset, the idea of, SWAT team task forces, of advisors, the idea of for schools and districts and associations, the idea just generally around, and Ryan, you and I have talked about some of this, the idea of best practices emerging for how to take a knowledge institution online. I think those things are going to be of enduring value. And I can't imagine working with a better group than this one, but I can't imagine a better group than this one being able to help articulate, even overwhelmed and even in a time of crisis, these kinds of almost maximalist principles of, you know, the world that should be versus the world that is.
Plus one.
Kurt, do you think we should look at that? I mean, is it date for update? The energy that's in this call is outstanding. It's like a concentrated version of the amazing energy that was in our group in February when we were there with Hewlett's generosity and just hospitality. But it may run out in 6 minutes in terms of time. Like, is there any meaning to going online ourselves with these decisions and sort of annotating the deliverables doc or writing a new doc or something like that that could actually give each of us a chance to, you know, we began this, Kurt, with your incredible notion of like everyone come up with a mission statement for, you know, what we'd like to see. And maybe now it's a time to like, what is the deliverable that we should like to see in this world when there is no extra time to do this kind of stuff, and or no time to waste, I guess is the better way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like there's at the moment a tremendous amount of focus on this urgently needed set of messages and supports for the world in this moment as we're experiencing it. I'd be in support of putting the energy where people's motivations lie, and I feel like it's consistent with the broader mission, but also responsive to what's going on. And so, a lot of what we've been talking about can connect to and can support work that's already underway. You know, we've talked about the ideas of getting these op-eds out into places and creating some sort of an advisory resource for people who are confronting these contracts with some sort of public statement of how they're going about it. I think those things are consistent with the broader Open 2020 mandate. Maybe that's, you know, the appropriate thing to focus on for the next few months, given that that's work that's going to get done anyway, right? I see some thumbs up. Yeah.
I was just thinking it might help to organize the many ideas that came up today into roughly three categories: the short term and very urgent, the medium term, and the longer term. And obviously the editorial is short-term and urgent, but writing principles or gathering principles is medium-term. It's not something that can be done quickly, but it's something that can be done in the background while we're doing the short-term things. And then long-term, I just added a comment to the chat thread about preparing for the end of the public health crisis. If we make progress during the crisis on open education and people think it's only justified by the emergency, then some of those arguments will weaken when the emergency disappears. And we should anticipate that and have arguments for sustaining this progress even afterwards.
Well said.
That's great.
Yeah, I agree 100%, Peter. I shared a blog post we just put up about open policy and expanding limitations and exceptions around copyright for educational resources. And that was an argument we made in that post, that this is important in crisis, and it's equally as important beyond. Like, it's open science is the right way to do science, whether or not you're in crisis or not. And that's the kind of revelation that the WHO is starting to have now, at least in our conversations with them, is they're saying, yeah, open science is great for COVID. Oh, you know what? It might be great all the time. Maybe we should start thinking that direction.
I've been tracking open access as a response to crises for more than 15 years. And I've noticed that during each one, everybody says, this is a good idea all the time, not just this time. And then after the crisis is over, most of that progress is rolled back. The argument is much less urgent to most people. Now, this is a bigger crisis than almost any we've had in a long time. And that's a reason to think the progress might continue. On the other hand, I do think it's important to anticipate the argument that it's no longer urgent and that other things can take priority again. For example, back to the Internet Archive, if that's justified by the emergency, then it's not justified when the emergency passes. And there are, call them emergency exceptions to fair use, but they would only work during an emergency. And if there are good arguments for continuing open education when the emergency is gone, we have to be ready to push them forward when the time comes.
And I think that's true regarding an S.J. Klein who's on this call, or you know, can articulate this better than me, but when it comes to information more generally, and knowledge most broadly, especially the infrastructure surrounding it. So I love that. I love that taxonomy of that time-based economy. And I think that's really important for our work. So I can say, Kurt, I think it'd be a good idea to make sure that the recording of this is available to everyone who's on our group and who wants to share it, but also that we, kind of strike into a collective document some more of this in case, you know, it's hard to pull this gang of rascals together on Zoom in the next few weeks. We at least can have a writing that people can point to and annotate.
Yeah. Let us continue to converse about that a little offline, post this meeting, figure out how that can roll out.
Yeah, I can't say enough about how much I was looking forward to this call how much I would look forward to being able to work with this group in this time. Like, there's this foxhole test, you know, like who do you want to be foxhole with when it comes to fighting? And boy, is this, we can rename this the foxhole.
Yeah, it seems maybe one note to put on it, but the crisis is kind of like an enzyme. In that it's speeding up, it's catalyzing a lot of decisions that might have unfolded over the next 10 or 15 years, and now they're going to unfold over the next 10 or 12 weeks. And so this is really the time. I'll be delighted to look over and annotate any action plan that you guys derive from this conversation, and to annotate it and look for ways to help. But I think that it sounds gruesome, but this, out of this horrible catastrophe, could come the greatest opportunity to scale our values in a more rapid fashion than we've ever seen, if we're smart and strategic about how we do it. And I take Peter's comments to heart. I think we absolutely need to keep in mind that as we propose these things, that we don't propose them as crisis measures, but that we propose them as best practices to preserve and extend the utility of public education.
Yeah, and as you know, Hal, as I remember you kind of speaking to in February when we were together, some of the challenges that entrenched interests will sense based on this enzyme working will produce an ab reaction to our work or to any work that will be more forceful and you know, in many ways more grotesque than anything we've seen to date. And this applies to what Peter was saying too. So as we're talking about preparing for a post-health crisis time, we also, that time is likely to be a time of even greater, I don't know, kind of anti-progressive activity than we've seen to date. And that's, that says something. So gird up.
Good. Well, I'll look for your I'll look for your distillation, and in the meantime, I'm continuing to work with the Michelson Foundation to try and get some of our arguments prominently placed as quickly as possible. And I know Angela's team is volunteered to help with that, and I'm really grateful.
Great.
Good to help. Thank you all. Yeah.
Great.
All right. So what do we do? Do we go online with our document? We circulate these notes. Kurt, try to meet again soon.
Yeah. Let's start with just sort of condensing the key points and some suggestions about what the next step looks like, and send that out.
That sounds really good. And thank you everyone for the. Oh, we should say that the June meeting is unlikely to take place, Cambridge. Surprise. But we have to figure out how to put up some benchmarks and put up some milestones for us moving forward. Time is essential.
And I'm going to spend some time thinking about and fantasizing about the next time we can all be together and share a meal together and share each other's physical company. I treasure all of you. And I'm so grateful we're part of a team, and look forward to working with all of you even more closely in the weeks and months ahead.
Well said, Hal.
Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah. Hey, healthy, everybody.
Peace.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.